Advanced Studio Classroom is on the air. Join us now as we talk about the world's business decisions on our advanced program today. Welcome to this very interesting article and this time together, the speed review from the Executive Book Summaries. We're glad that you're here today, Bill, because you like to talk about business subjects, don't you?
Yeah, I sure do, Doris. It's always interesting to talk about different business leaders, concepts, and companies. And this is a really interesting one. We're talking about great business decisions.
And Josh, I know that you've had a business yourself in the States for a while, after you were a studio classroom teacher, then you came back again. And do you feel that there's a lot of things going on in these business decisions that people don't know about?
I sure do, yeah. There's certainly the public perception of how you want to be perceived by your investors and employees and competitors. But behind the scenes, oftentimes these are just normal people trying to navigate a very fast-changing world.
Well, in this article on page 26 and 27 of our magazine is interesting, but it makes me just want to know more as I read it. So what do they mean by that? Did you feel that way, Bill?
Oh, yeah. As I studied for this article, Doris, of course, then I went on the internet and I was trying to dig up every piece of information I could as far as the book. I wanted to find out reviews and I wanted to find out more about like what are the case studies were that they were covering.
I think that this article will be interesting not only to people in business, because everybody has to make decisions all the time in our lives. Isn't that true?
That's right. Every day we're faced with big choices and small choices that impact our lives, and we have to base our decisions on the information that we have. And some decisions work out and some don't.
So we're going to find out some things that probably you didn't know. I found out some things I didn't know. What about you?
Yeah, I did. Some that I was aware of, but then there were plenty in here that I didn't realize. So that's great. It's a great learning experience.
So let's take a look inside the world's business decisions by reading the first part of the lesson on page 26.
Inside the world's best business decisions. Bold decisions and innovation pay off for some companies. Given the thousands of business decisions made every day by company executives and business owners around the world, selecting the 18 greatest business decisions of all time is no small feat. In The Greatest Business Decisions of All Time, 9 Fortune magazine editors have compiled such a list, including modern and historic decisions from companies around the globe. Vern Harnish, the Fortune magazine contributor who launched the idea of the book and whose succinct summaries precede the case study on every decision, explains, "In the end, the 18 management decisions that made our final list stood out from others because they were counterintuitive. They went against the grain of popular practice." For example, Harnish continues, "What executive in his right mind would give his employees time to daydream? But that's exactly what 3M CEO William McKnight did in 1948.
Well, all of you reading this article will say, yes, that's true. We have thousands of decisions that we have to make. Sometimes you think you won't have to make decisions, but you've already made them. But something comes up all the time, doesn't it, Josh?
It sure does. And in business, as an owner or a manager or a supervisor, your decisions can impact hundreds of people.
And one of the things that causes us to make decisions is maybe the market's not good, or some tragedy happens, or there's an earthquake or a typhoon or something, somebody gets sick from your product. All kinds of things come up you never even dreamed of.
No, you know, things happen that are unexpected, and so you're actually forced to react. And one of the things is when you're forced to react, you may not have all the information you need, and then you get into an area where you might make bad decisions.
So we're going to talk about this in the next couple of days, but I don't know why they decided to make this, you know, write this kind of a book, because it said 18 of the greatest business decisions of all times. Now, whoever would have thought of that? It sounds like a good idea to sell a book to me.
It does.
You know, I mean, how do you know those are the biggest ones, really?
No, I think, you know, hindsight, where we can look back and see how some of these companies' success happened, certainly helps. But it's interesting that they came up with 18. It's not a number that means anything in business or anything, but perhaps that's as many as they could fit within the confines of the book.
Well, that's enough, I think. So it says it's no small thing. It's no small feat. It just means event. It's not a small thing to do. It's a big thing to do.
Well, if you're picking out 18, you're going to have to be looking at 500, 1,000, 2,000 business decisions that you think are significant in the, quote, history of business. So just narrowing that field down is no small accomplishment, no small feat.
But if you're a businessman and you see this book that just came out that says the greatest business decisions of all time, don't you think you'd be interested in reading it?
Oh, definitely. If we say something is of all time, we mean it's in all of history, every business that's ever been created. So
That's kind of impossible.
Hyperbole a little bit. We're something that's probably not going to deliver what it says
but
it does.
But Fortune magazine thought that would be a good idea for an article. So 9 of the Fortune magazine editors got together and they made this list. And how did they decide what's going to be on the list?
Well, they were looking at modern and historic decisions from companies around the globe. We see in lines 8, 9, and 10 right there. So not only the ones we're familiar with in the last 10 years, but the last 150 years.
So Vern Harnish, who's the Fortune magazine contributor who started or launched this idea, this book, it says succinct. Oh, yeah, that's a very definite word. What does succinct mean, Bill?
Oh, succinct means to keep it short and simple and straight on the topic.
That's hard to have a succinct summary. Well, that's even hard to say.
This is a great word for all of our listeners, all of our students who are giving speeches, presentations. Make sure you keep your presentation succinct.
These summaries precede case studies, and I know we've talked about case studies in the advanced class several times. It's about looking in at the inner workings of a business decision, of a business problem, looking at the players and the outcomes and the results of how a business reacted to market changes.
Well, that was really actually a good idea. So in the end, they found about 18 that they thought would be on the final list that stood out. Now, why did they think these were good? Why would they choose these?
Well, they feel that they were counterintuitive, meaning that they weren't the expected result if a company or the expected decision that you would make. When you see that word intuitive in there from the word intuition, how would you make a decision? What's your gut reaction to something? And this goes against that. Don't do what feels right, but do perhaps what is difficult to do or what others wouldn't.
Right. Mainly is that other people would say that's not a good idea, but you felt like it was. So they go against the grain. And this is an expression that we often use. When we go against the grain, it's not the ordinary way that we do things. It's a different way.
Yeah. When you go against the grain, you're not going with the crowd. You're not following the herd. This actually comes from the grain is the way like grass grows. And then actually when you go against the grain, the direction that the grass grows, you're going against that.
But even people that are carpenters, when they're making things out of wood, they have to go along like the grain of the wood, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
And they don't go the wrong direction. They have to follow the flow, doesn't it mean?
Well, when you go with the grain, it's easier to cut wood.
Right.
But when you're going against the grain, it's a challenge.
That's true.
Yeah. And I did that as a business owner. When we were a web design company, we felt that the audience's use of the web was changing and more people were spending time in Facebook and on social media, and that we should branch out into other areas of digital marketing. And it was challenging at first. People said, oh, your web design business is going so well. Why would you try something else and do things on mobile phones and other screens? And it was counterintuitive.
So it went against the grain, right? This is why this Harnish, he continues to say, he says, what kind of executive that's thinking straight, that's in his right mind, why would he say to his employees, take time out to daydream? Hey, no, you're supposed to work. Don't start thinking of other things.
He just wanted to be a nice guy. He wanted everybody to like
him. No, he wanted fresh ideas. He knew that when you give people time to think, they might come up with greater ideas.
That's right. And it's a policy that Google has famously adopted over the last couple of years. And before reading this article, I didn't know the idea was almost 70 years old, this idea of giving your employees the opportunity to not work on their daily work, but put their mental energies towards innovation.
You know, I did that a long time ago, too. When we started television, people would sit at their desk to try to write the television scripts, you know. I'd say, oh, go out and walk in the park or do something, get ideas. Don't just sit at your desk. So that was long before that.
Before Google.
That was before Google. That was
there was life before Google.
Yeah, that's
hard
right.
To believe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you've made lots of decisions, Doris, that were counterintuitive.
That's true. And also we gave people and worked at our company, that ORTV and Studio Classroom, time to think about things, to get away and think about them or to leave the office. They don't have to just sit at their desks because they can think better that way. And that's what the 3M CEO did. And 3M makes all kinds of products like the sticky notes and all kinds of paper products that are really intuitive.
That's right. The Post-it note is what I think they're most famous for.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Doris, I had underlined there at the bottom of the left column, in his right mind. And that's kind of a funny idiom we'll see once in a while. What executive in his right mind?
Well, if he's thinking straight, Bill.
Yeah. Anybody? Sanity.
You're right.
You know.
He's thinking straight. He's not going to do that. But he did that back in 1948. So it's interesting that you have to give your minds time to think about things. And these bold decisions that you make, they might pay off. So let's read more about this because it says new takes on familiar tales. And we're going to find out more about that.
New takes on familiar tales. Many business book readers will be familiar with McKnight's decision to give employees a certain percentage of free time to work on the project of their own choosing. Other familiar stories include Johnson & Johnson's decision in 1982 to take action in the wake of the Tylenol poisonings that caused the deaths of 7 people in the Chicago area. Jack Welch's revitalization of GE Corporate University at Crotonville, New York, and Nordstrom's focus on boundary-less customer service. In the knowledgeable hands of the Fortune editors, the short chapters of even these well-known cases make for interesting reading thanks to unexpected details.
So these things were not really new with Google, that they've been going on a long time, haven't they? These ideas.
Certainly. And as we were talking about during our break here, that there have been many great business leaders, great business decisions long before Google and Steve Jobs and Bill Gates.
Well, look at line 9 here. They talk about other familiar stories, talking about Johnson & Johnson's decision. Now, when I think of Johnson & Johnson, I think about baby powder and stuff like that because they were very well known for things like that, weren't they?
That's right. Yes, global consumer packaged goods company. But I think their most famous business case study was in the Tylenol deaths. And this was widespread deaths in the U.S. where tainted bottles on the shelves of Tylenol were causing death. And
why did that happen? What happened?
Oh, well, unfortunately, somebody put cyanide poisoning in some bottles of Tylenol pills.
Why would they do that, Bill? Are you crazy?
Crazy, seeking attention, wanting to hurt people, wanting to hurt the company. Just somebody who's crazy.
Isn't that terrible, though? So people didn't dare buy Tylenol because it might have some poison in it. And what happened? There were 7 people in the Chicago area died from taking it. Well, that was a terrible thing. I remember that.
It was. And they sort of created a textbook study of crisis management, of how to react when a company is under siege like this by the market forces, and reacting with honesty and stepping out and taking culpability, responsibility over what you can. And PR companies have really followed this model.
What action did they actually take then?
Well, the one thing they did is they actually recalled all of their products. I mean, all of the Tylenol products, and they just pulled everything off their shelf across the country. That was one thing. And then the other thing is they even offered the people that had bought their products, even if you had it at home, you could bring it in, turn it in, and get it replaced. And so by replacing all of this, they spent $100 million recalling all of these products.
$100 million. Now, that's a lot of money to spend. Just say, okay, we'll just get rid of all the products. And most of the products were good. It was just that one place where they did it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Just in the Chicago area.
But people didn't trust it anymore.
Well, there was a couple things. Well, the amazing thing is they made this decision. They did it almost immediately, which was really good. But the other thing is they were afraid of copycats. They were afraid once this thing hits the media, okay, some crazy guy in Chicago did this. Their concern was there's going to be a crazy guy in Los Angeles that does the same thing, New York. That happens a lot.
Yeah, that's true.
They wanted to prevent that.
Right. So they did something that not only they just took it off the shelves and just gave up on it, they replaced the stock with tamper-proof containers, and that's when they started a lot of those. Sometimes it's hard to open those right now because they're hard to open, but they replaced it with a new design that people couldn't do that with. You could tell if it'd been opened.
They call them child-proof, but sometimes I think they're adult-proof.
Right, you can hardly open them sometimes. And then they put little seals across there, so if that seal is broken, you know that somebody's been in there. They didn't have that before.
No. And we've seen companies lately, like Toyota had recalls of their products mm-hmm. about 4 years mm-hmm. ago
right.
and didn't react as fast. They still didn't learn the lesson from Johnson & Johnson that you have to react fast.
You make a good point regarding the tamper-proof bottles. Many of our listeners, because of the age, don't realize that before this, so many bottles of pills that were in the drugstore and grocery stores, you could just open them up. And there would just be like a cotton ball in there.
Right.
And then you could have access to the pills. And prior to this, people didn't think anything about it.
No.
But then all it takes is one nut poisoning people. And now every bottle has got the plastic wrapping on it that, you know, it's almost like you're trying to break into a safe.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Even
yeah.
syrup and orange
you can
juice,
hardly open
not
it.
Just medicine.
Right.
It all started with this.
Hmm. And then they have a little kind of aluminum seal over it. And if that's broken, you know, somebody's opened it, then you'd say, oh, I'm not going to buy this. So they did make what they call tamper-proof. To tamper means to do something to change it. And they had tamper-proof containers and bottles, and I think that was a wonderful, wonderful thing to do. Really.
Yeah, and it's spread to so many different products, of course, not just pharmaceuticals.
Well, I think they made their $100 million back then, didn't they?
They did. Yeah,
oh, yeah.
They did.
That could have put a company out of business,
mm-hmm.
but it didn't. Yeah. Another example is GE. General Electric was revitalized, it says, by Jack Welch, the famous CEO of the company in the 80s.
What did he do?
Well, he changed the company entirely and put its new focus on training, and his Six Sigma area of training kind of revitalized that. Of course, he did cut a lot of jobs too, right?
Well, he did. But, you know, before Jack Welch came in, GE was always a good company,
yes.
but they had gotten a little sluggish and their performance was just so-so. And then he came in. Yes, he slashed a lot of jobs. He switched some of their priorities. He revitalized GE, brings them back to life. And actually, their financial performance when he was there then greatly improved.
And he's big on feedback for employees, grading every employee A through F on their performance over the previous year. And then an employee gets to grade his supervisor as well.
Mm.
So it's up and down the hierarchical chain in terms of feedback. And then there's, you know, transparency in terms of how well am I doing? Am I up for this promotion? Well, you fell here, here, and here, and you need to improve in these other areas.
So he did quite a bit then to do that. Well, the next one it talks about here is Nordstrom's, which is a Seattle company. And in fact, I know some of the Nordstrom family. I've met some of them. And they focus on boundaryless customer service. And I don't think I've ever seen a company that is as good as Nordstrom at that. I know I bought a pair of shoes once, and I brought them out to Taiwan, and I didn't have a chance to go back to the States for several months, but there was something wrong with the shoes. It didn't fit. And about 6 months later, I went back to the States, and they just took the shoes back and gave me my money back.
No
like
receipt,
that.
No Nothing. Questions asked.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah, it is really. It's an amazing customer service policy that they will let you bring these products back, and they will not question you, not look for paperwork, like Josh had said. They'll just say, fine, and that's it. And they will give you your money back, or they'll give you a replacement product. And it makes me think of how many companies that we deal with that make you jump through hoops to get a replacement.
You can hardly ever get anything back, right?
And they have never learned the lesson from Nordstrom. The lesson from Nordstrom is, if you do this with people, they will keep coming back. They will keep giving us business, and that pays off in the long run.
That's right. We have so many choices of where to shop. Then, of course, a place that appreciates your business is going to be a place that you frequent.
Well, Nordstrom says something else that a lot of companies don't do, that people don't know about, is that people that are even high executives and supervisors and work up in the business office and they've been promoted up there, they have to go down one day every month and sell shoes. They have to work downstairs with everybody else, and they don't just stand there. They have to sell shoes, too, because they said, don't think that you get too far away from the customer. You have to know what the customers think. Isn't that interesting, Bill?
That's great. That is really great. It does a couple of things. One, it builds in humility, and also it lets the executives get in touch with their customers.
Right.
Yeah.
And they don't just stand there and pretend like they're doing it. They have to show that they sold shoes, that they have to still be a shoe salesman.
Can they get fired if they don't sell enough shoes?
Well, they might get
promoted.
They might get their salary reduced. Who knows,
right.
You know?
Because it's all about the customer. The customer's right at the top of the Nordstrom pyramid, and then the customer service person, the clerk, is there right underneath them, the closest person to them. And it's a philosophy we ascribe here at Studio Classroom. We try to spend time with our students, listen to our students, get your feedback, incorporate that into our programming. So hopefully you are feeling close and connected to your Studio Classroom teachers.
That's true. And there's so many examples. We'll talk about more of them even today and tomorrow. But it says here that, you know, these things are they're familiar stories, but perhaps you didn't know these stories before. So now they'll become familiar. You can pass them on to your friends. And whether you get this book or not, I think it's a very interesting concept to see why some of these companies have been so great and the decisions that were made, that's why those companies are still in existence. Isn't that right?
Well, yeah, they certainly, some of them were survival decisions, like Johnson & Johnson, or even Jack Welch turning GE around. And the Nordstrom one is just great. Another thing about this Nordstrom decision is I'm thinking it reinforces with the employees that the upper management is part of them, too. They're
right.
Not separate. They're not better. They're not royalty.
Right.
That the executives are also just like us. We're all in this together.
Well, the book also talks about some companies you definitely have heard of, Apple and Walmart, that made some big decisions that changed its future. But we'll talk about one tomorrow that I wasn't aware of, the soft soap brand. I figured that was owned by some big conglomerate, you know, some big packaged goods company. But interesting to hear their story that they started out as just a small mom-and-pop company.
Well, you'll find out about that tomorrow. But in the knowledgeable hands of the Fortune editors, it says, because after all, the editors of Fortune, really, they do have a big job because they have all the businesses looking at what they write and what they do. But the short chapters of even these very well-known cases made very interesting reading. Why?
Well, I think it's because the unexpected details, that's one thing. There's a lot of – we know of these companies, and, you know, everybody has heard of all of these companies. But a lot of times we don't know how they got to be so well-known.
How come they're bigger than the others, you know, right?
Yeah. So we don't know that, you know, why does Apple – you know, dominate the smartphone market? Well, you know, you have to learn about some of the meetings, you know, that were involved. And what did Steve Jobs do or say in those meetings?
Or right. Walmart. Yeah. Why is Walmart such a Wall Street darling and JCPenney is about to go out of business?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They seem to be very similar companies to me.
Yeah, well, that's true. But even people, when we're going to talk about things like Apple and some of those things, we're going to find like even companies that we know of like HTC, they were also in the making the – they were actually PC computers. They decided to go into the smartphone business. And that's what changed theirs too. These decisions by their executives
yep.
have made them world-known companies, haven't they?
You know, Doris, one of the things we've been talking about Apple and HTC and these companies, but one of the companies that we had talked about was Ford. We'll go back 100 years ago, and Henry
sure.
Ford, a decision he made changed the automotive industry and also literally society.
Made everybody be able to afford cars, right?
Yeah, and what he did was he doubled the wages of his employees in 1914. Unheard of. Because at that time, pretty much industrial workers were viewed almost as slaves.
Right.
And management didn't treat them with respect. He saw them as an investment. And it just changed everything as far as during the Industrial Revolution.
So these are very interesting things to talk about. And I know you'll all want to be here tomorrow when we hear these other examples. And you might even want to get this book. It sounds pretty interesting to me. But we'll be here tomorrow to discuss the rest of these decisions that they just talked about. See you then.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.